Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Doyle Baker. I'm a deputy district attorney, and I represent the people in this case. With me at the appellant's table is Ms. Sherry Dance from the Office of the Child Representative, appearing as an amicus. Because of the way that we've split the argument in this case, with Ms. Dance having 10 minutes to argue the GAL issue, I'm going to take the issues, or I propose to take the issues, somewhat out of order from the brief, starting with the jurisdictional argument, then proceeding with the social worker arguments, and if there's any time left for me, I'll argue on the GAL as well. Regarding the question of jurisdiction in this case, we filed our appeal with the Court of Appeals under Section 16-12-1021, and that statute allows the prosecution to appeal any decision of a court in a criminal case on any question of law, and it also provides that the prosecution may appeal any order of a court that dismisses one or more counts of a charging document before trial, and the statute states that such orders shall constitute a final order that shall be immediately appealable. And there's some question about whether the order that we appealed, given the circumstances in which it came up, is a final order. We believe that under the plain language of the statute, the answer to that question is that, yes, indeed, it was a final order. The statute singles out any dismissal order as a final appealable order.
And the prosecution asked for this dismissal, right?
Well, what the prosecution said, Your Honor, was they couldn't proceed in light of the order excluding evidence, and they would understand if the court dismissed the appeal. So they didn't object to the dismissal. That is correct. But still, under the plain language of the statute, that appears to be an order that is covered by what the legislature put in here.
Well, I think the question is whether they're actually appealing from the order dismissing. I mean, the thing that's kind of hard conceptually is that the people are not arguing that the court erred in dismissing the case. Rather, the people were supportive, basically, of that.
Well,
so it's not the order dismissing that you're appealing from. It seems to be instead the preceding evidentiary order.
The people really felt, and this was the prosecutor's judgment, that under the circumstances, they could not successfully prosecute the case. And when you're a prosecutor, you're charged with doing justice to go forward on a case that you don't feel
I totally understand the reasons,
right.
but I mean, I'm not quarreling with that. But the point is, the people aren't claiming error in the order of dismissal.
Well, they are to the extent that the order of dismissal is based on what they view as a erroneous interpretation of statutes applying to the GAL and the social worker.
Of course, that's a different order, though, isn't it?
Well, it's a different
order. The order of dismissal may be the inevitable result of the earlier order, but it is not part of that order.
It is a different order, but it's tied to the order of dismissal in such a way that because of the trial court's orders related to the social worker and the GAL, those orders directly resulted in the dismissal. We have an issue with the court's orders in that regard. We also have an issue with the fact that this case was dismissed, even though we understand why it was dismissed. And
The state doesn't have any other way of bringing this appeal, is that right?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
The state doesn't have any other way of bringing this appeal other than through this device?
It places us in a difficult situation. This was a motion in limine that was filed the morning that trial was scheduled to begin. We had, I think, about 2 hours before jury selection was supposed to start. In theory, we could seek a petition under Rule 21, but of course, filing that does not deprive the trial court of jurisdiction. The case would continue to proceed, and by the time jeopardy attaches, we are without a remedy. So we looked at the plain language of the statute. We looked at the case law. Specifically, there's a Court of Appeals case, People versus Daly, where something similar happened. And based on the law that we saw, and based on the prosecutor's feelings about the case, made the choice to go ahead and honestly tell the court, in the prosecutor's opinion, that, that the case couldn't proceed. At that point, when it was dismissed, we had
appealable order. I mean, I think the ethics are wonderful. I mean, and your submission of the Fry case are to be admired, what you're saying. But fundamentally, it seems like it's an evidentiary question that you lost on, not a question of the law. And well, you asked for the dismissal. I understand the bind you were in the trial court. I mean, that's reasonably understandable.
I think that
there may be ways to solve that, but that's really not here.
I think there are questions of law regarding, number one, what's the scope of the privilege? Does it apply here for a GAL?
Even assuming that on that is 100% correct, still.
Well, but it also
disagree
it's
with,
an evidentiary ruling that, I'm sorry.
Wait a minute, that has nothing to do with the dismissal of the case, except that you can't prove a case. It's exactly like the Fry case, which you submitted to us.
I would say that Fry is different.
Okay,
and,
now.
And not surprising. The difference in Fry is Fry involved an appeal from an order denying a revocation of probation. And that is an order that, number one, does not fit under this court's case law definition. Fry.
I got the wrong case,
Your Honor. Fry, this is similar to Fry in the ruling that they made. But the difference is, in our case before the Court of Appeals, they applied the plain language of the statute governing prosecution appeals. And Fry didn't do that. What the court and Fry did was they jumped immediately to the legislative history that they saw as pertinent to the act. Didn't really analyze the language in 1612.102.
I'm really interested in the interaction between the statute and the legislature's intent, whether we truly have jurisdiction under this statute in tandem with our Rule 21 jurisdiction to take important matters that are interlocutory. Now, you would concede that you could have asked the trial court for a stay of its evidentiary ruling, or you could have come here with a Rule 21 for us to sort out this conceivably very important issue of attorney ethics and guardian ad litem. So why didn't you go the Rule 21 route?
Well, we could have asked for a stay from the trial court. We were up against Speedy. We had about 5 weeks left, and we'd have to reschedule the trial if the Rule 21 was denied. I'm not sure if the prosecutor didn't think of asking for a stay. Perhaps the prosecutor knew that she couldn't try this case within Speedy if there was not a granting of a Rule 21, so she didn't ask. But again, the problem was we had 2 hours before the trial started. If we had a week or two, perhaps we could have filed a Rule 21, and we could have made that work. But we were in a difficult position, and the prosecution always is with double jeopardy concerns. We had a ruling that we had a problem with, and really, as a practical matter, Rule 21 would have been a very difficult avenue for us to take in this case, given the shortness of the time that was left to trial.
But you're asserting there is jurisdiction over this kind of a case by right of the statute. See, that's the difficult argument.
That's correct. And I think that when you talk about the legislative intent, the legislature's intent can be read from the plain language of the statute. It's very clear they're talking about any order of dismissal. They didn't.
Mr. Baker, let me ask it to you this way. If we accepted your view of the jurisdiction that we have by virtue of the statute that we're talking about here, would there be any order of the court, any evidentiary order, any motion, you know, granting of a motion in limine by the trial court, which could not be reviewed under the statute simply by dismissing the case and then appealing with your argument that you can therefore appeal because it's a final judgment under the statute, and you're appealing as a question of law any evidentiary ruling whatsoever that the judge made. I mean, does that open this up? Well, what are the limitations, if any, if we accept your view?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think there would be constraints on prosecution appeals, and I think that it would be foolish for prosecutors to assume that any order that they don't like, any perceived error they see in a trial court ruling, they can...
And why would that be foolish? What are the constraints that would remain pursuant to your argument?
Right. Well, we'll use this case as an example. We've told the judge we can't proceed in light of your ruling. So now we've appealed. Ultimately, if we lose this appeal, and I think this was the concern of the Court of Appeals in Frye, that we'd just come back and refile the case. There's a line of case law in the U.S. Supreme Court and in this court that holds that a trial court can use its supervisory powers to dismiss a case where the prosecution engages in essentially...
So maybe the trial court wouldn't have to allow a refiling, but would every ruling be appealable?
Well, I think that a prosecutor would have to be careful about that. If you're looking at a ruling...
Because if they lose, they may not be able to refile. I mean, but the question, regardless of that concern, whether it's a wise decision by the prosecutor or not, my query is, would every single order of a trial court be appealable by this mechanism that you're urging?
No, only if the prosecution did as the prosecution did in this case.
Just to get to
just to say, Judge, we can't proceed. Now, if the prosecution makes that choice, they've limited their options in another way. They can't try the case if they lose the appeal, I don't think, because if we come back, say we lose the appeal in this case, and we return to the district court and we refile the charge, and we come in and the judge...
So stated differently, your view is the intent of the legislature was to let the prosecutor make the decision as to whether any order is appealable by deciding whether to dismiss the case in order to pursue the appeal.
Well, I think so, under the plain language of the statute. And it's frankly consistent with the discretion, the wide discretion that prosecutors get to decide whether to file charges in the first place or whether to continue with the case.
But and maybe you should talk about gluttony, which is what you started to talk about.
Gluttony.
By mistake when you misunderstood that for a moment.
Yes, gluttony, not Frye, but gluttony, was a case where the prosecution appealed the denial of an order to revoke probation. And that appeal was, the Court of Appeals ruled on it on the merits. This court dismissed because there was no final appealable order. And as I read gluttony, there's two reasons why it's not a final appealable order. Number one, the order at issue doesn't fit within the case law definition that this court has come up with for what a final appealable order is. It didn't resolve the case in its entirety. Number two, as Gwatney recognized, there are certain circumstances where the legislature has taken it upon itself to define what a final appealable order is. And in the context of a dismissal, they've done that. They've also done it by saying that a motion granting, or an order granting a motion for a new trial is a final appealable order. But a motion or an order
granting a motion. When gluttony relies upon the final judgment requirement of the of Appellate Rule 1,
right.
Is that wrong in gluttony, or is that just distinguishable for some reason?
Not at all. It's not wrong. It's perfectly consistent, and I think that with that rule, and I think that the position we're taking is perfectly consistent with that rule. We don't have an order, I guess, that would necessarily fit this court's definition of a final judgment. But what we do have is an order that fits what the legislature has called a final judgment for purposes of 1612.1021. It's an order from a dismissal of charges and any order.
So just so I understand, are you saying that in Gwatney, where you don't have a statutory final order because it's dismissing a count, then it's okay to go to Appellate Rule 1 to figure out what a final judgment is, but when you actually have an order, you don't need to go that route, you just have the statutory definition. Am I understanding you correctly?
You need to have a final order for purposes of Appellate Rule 1 or you can't proceed. You determine if you have a final order by looking at the case law definition. Is this an order that disposes of the entire case? Or you can look at the statutes and determine from those if the legislature has declared that something is a final judgment. And then you can proceed from there. We're not suggesting that the prosecution should be able to manipulate the proceedings and take an appeal and then come back later on and refile charges. We don't think that's appropriate. We think that a prosecutor in a situation like this has a decision to make. Do I think this evidence is so important that I can't try the case, or am I willing to live with the judge's ruling?
Mr. Baker, can I ask you a question about that? I'm a little curious about the way you're dealing with finality and also question of law. The statute seems to say you can appeal a question of law. Are you conceding or suggesting in some way that you can't appeal a question of law if it occurred during the case once the case becomes final?
Well, I think you can appeal a question of law that occurs during a case once the case becomes final.
So is the whole question then, when do you have a final judgment?
That's correct. And the problem for us is to get meaningful relief in an appeal, we've got to be able to appeal before jeopardy is attached.
But there may be other remedies against you, as you suggested, that is, a judge may refuse to allow you to dismiss, or on some grounds he may refuse to allow you to refile. But is there anything in the statute that suggests to you your motive or the reason for a case becoming final has anything to do with whether it's final and constitutes a final judgment under Rule 1?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that statute is clear. It talks about any order of dismissal, and the legislature certainly could have made the distinction between orders of dismissal that were entered over the prosecution's objection or with their consent.
Do you think that second sentence specifically allows you to appeal an order of dismissal, or simply says an order of dismissal of one count or a number of counts is a final judgment? And if that's true, that it's only a final judgment, then you still have to be appealing a question of law. Is that not true?
Well, I think that as the statute reads, it allows us to appeal any court order that dismisses one or more counts in a charging document prior to trial. I think we do have both in this case. I think we have questions of law and dismissal. I think, for example, in the context of a preliminary hearing, I'm not sure that it would always involve a question of law, but a judge maybe determining that evidence was insufficient to go forward on the charge. So I'm not sure that under this that it's necessary that you appeal a question of law if the case is dismissed.
See, this is allowing you to appeal a question of law, but then separately providing you that you can appeal a dismissal of a count.
I believe so.
Okay. And I guess the last point is, but do you have to be, if you are appealing a question of law and the case is over, is that allowed necessarily, even though the ruling on the question of law is not the thing that made the case be over? Do we have two separate requirements here?
Well, I think it is. I think that prosecutors occasionally take appeals to the Court of Appeals on questions of law that have been decided and a case is over, and they're asking essentially for an advisory opinion from the Court of Appeals.
That's not the instance here? I mean, if you prevail here, this is a live prosecution?
I believe it is, Your Honor, because jeopardy is never attached.
Okay.
And that's our big concern. We want to have meaningful relief, and to do that, we need to file our appeal before we're out of time.
But I take it the point you were making is let's assume we have a ruling on a privilege question before trial, and the judge construes the privilege to be broad enough to exclude some evidence you want to put in. If instead of trying to appeal right then, you proceed to trial and you lose, and the defendant is acquitted, do you think you can go back then and appeal that ruling on privilege as a matter of law, because now you have a final judgment?
I think we could. I've tried it. I've made the Court of Appeals angry at me, or irritated with me, I guess would be a fairer way of putting it. They don't like questions of law where there's no meaningful relief available.
Clearly have examples, though, do we not, of accepting questions of law, say, on granting a defense or giving a particular instruction or something along that nature, after the trial is over, assuming there is an acquittal. Jeopardy would bar retrial, and yet
we could appeal. But again, we don't like to do it. It's typically not very helpful.
And I didn't mean to be challenged in the tactics here. I'm simply trying to establish the point whether you're agreeing or believe that if you had a ruling on a question of law someplace during the course of the proceedings, that would be appealable by the prosecution once the case becomes final, however it becomes final.
That's correct. At this point, I've cut into the amicus time, so I'll cede the rest of my time to Ms. Danz. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Sherry Danz. I am a staff attorney with the Office of the Child's Representative, and I am representing the OCR as amicus on the sole question of whether statements made by a child to her GAL are confidential communications protected by the attorney-client privilege. The OCR requests that this court hold the Court of Appeals erred in its ruling because neither the duty of confidentiality as set forth under Colorado Rule of Professional Conduct 1.6 nor the attorney-client privilege, I should say, are compatible with the best interest model of representation that the Colorado General Assembly has enacted for guardians ad litem in Colorado. In my presentation, I plan to cover 3 points fairly quickly. First, Colorado's best interest model of guardian ad litem representation. Second, why confidentiality and privilege are incompatible with this model. Third, why Chief Justice Directive 0406 does not establish a confidential relationship between children and their guardians ad litem. Beginning with the model of representation, resolution of this question is important for two reasons. First, the duties of confidentiality and the attorney-client privilege apply turns on the functions of a guardian ad litem and the role that the guardian ad litem plays. Second, in its ruling that Chief Justice Directive 0406 requires strict adherence to all rules of professional conduct, the Court of Appeals in this case calls into question the very essence of the guardian ad litem role. Unlike traditional counsel, guardians ad litem in Colorado are charged with representing the best interests of a child. Where this differs from traditional counsel is that at the end of the day, it is the guardian ad litem, not the child, who determines the objective of the representation. This puts the GAL squarely in conflict with Rule 1.2 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. Whether we like it or not, this is what the legislature intended to do. The definition section of the Children's Code clearly defines guardian ad litem differently than counsel is defined. Additionally, under Section 19.3.203 of the Colorado Revised Statutes, the guardian ad litem has different responsibilities than that of counsel of record. Not only is the guardian ad litem charged with representing the interests of the child, but the guardian ad litem's representation regarding reasonable efforts to return home, to reunify, or to remain with their parents is limited to the situations in which it is determined to be in the best interest of the child.
Yes. As far as the best interest of the child and the GAL's representation, who decides that? Isn't that the GAL who decides what's in the best interest of the child?
It is, Your Honor.
Why doesn't that apply as well to the privilege and confidentiality idea? That is, I guess to put it this way, can the GAL decide that some things the child tells the GAL cannot be revealed?
Your Honor, I believe that that is one way to resolve this issue, and I believe that that is the way that some GALs in Colorado have been functioning. I would say that in this case, in the record, while it's not cited in our briefs, the district attorney does make a record at the April 16, 2007 hearing that it is in the guardian's or the child's best interest that the guardian ad litem in this case testify. And that
the GAL made that record.
Yes. Well, do you know what, Your Honor? The GAL did not actually make a record because it was a district attorney presenting the information to the court.
But I was unclear whether the representation is that the GAL believed that to be in the child's best interest or that the district attorney believed that to be in the child's best interest.
I think the best answer is that the district attorney stated that the GAL believed it was in the child's best interest and that that was a reasonable belief.
Well, but and does that make sense as a model for deciding this? That is, I think what you're telling me is the GAL, perhaps, believed in this case that it was up to the GAL to decide whether this confidentiality should be revealed and that the GAL decided that it should. That would make privilege and confidentiality, attorney-client privilege and confidentiality, consistent with the GAL role. It's just that the GAL is the one making the decision as to whether to exercise the privilege and whether to maintain the confidentiality.
I think that is true, Your Honor. I think particularly with regard to Rule 1.6 and confidentiality, I believe it's slightly more problematic with the attorney-client privilege because of the fact that the attorney-client privilege is set forth as an attorney-client privilege and the guardian ad litem does not function in the role of having an attorney-client relationship. But I do think that would be a satisfactory resolution of the issues in this case.
Would it be a satisfactory explanation of the role of the GAL in your view?
I believe it would, Your Honor.
Would there also be other kinds of confidential information which the GAL in his or her discretion could choose not to divulge?
Under what Justice Martinez proposes, I believe that is true. I think that maybe a situation would be in which the guardian ad litem felt that possibly even for the purposes of his or her relationship, or in this case, her relationship with the young woman in this case, that it was important for her not to testify in a criminal case and that instead to pursue advocacy and to have a working relationship with that young person in the dependency and neglect case. In other instances, as in this case, at the end of the day, the guardian ad litem did decide that it was in the best interest for that child for her to testify in the criminal case. This court has recognized that Colorado does require best interest representation, where and as recently as in the case of In Re JCT, where best interest representation becomes incompatible with the attorney-client privilege and with the duty of confidentiality is when guardians ad litem are prevented from sharing information that is pertinent to a child's best interest with either their appointing court or another court. It is clear although the Court of Appeals in this case merged the privilege analysis with the confidentiality analysis, they are actually two distinct concepts. Privilege would prevent the guardian ad litem from testifying as to statements made, which sometimes may be necessary for the advancement of a child's best interest, while confidentiality would prevent the guardian ad litem from sharing any information related to the subject of the representation. As a result, preventing the guardian ad litem from sharing any information relevant to the child's best interest. That is not the intent of the statute, and the rules themselves state that the extent of an attorney-client relationship and the responsibilities of an attorney are defined by substantive law external to the rules. I see that I'm running out of time, so I would quickly like to address why Chief Justice Directive 0406 does not establish a confidential relationship between children and their guardians ad litem. Although Chief Justice Directive 0406 does emphasize Rule 1.14, Rule 1.14 itself provides that the attorney must maintain a normal attorney-client relationship only as far as is reasonably possible. It is not reasonable to require guardians ad litem to withhold information in contradiction to their statutory responsibilities. The Chief Justice directive itself does not show any intent to change the model of representation in Colorado or to put the guardians ad litem in a position in which their statutory responsibilities are in conflict with their ethical responsibilities. Even if this were the intent of the Chief Justice directive, it would not trump the statutes themselves. The implication of this court's ruling does impact the safety and well-being of children, particularly those who are not able to consent. For that reason, to consent to the disclosure of the information, for that reason, we would ask you to reverse the Court of Appeals ruling.
Good morning. Elizabeth McClintock, I represent the respondent in this matter, Mark Gabrachesky. At council table is Jeff Coy. He is amicus counsel, and predominantly he will be discussing the guardian ad litem issue unless the court has questions for me on that. I will be focusing on the jurisdictional issue, and then if we can get to it, the social worker aspect and guardian ad litem if we can. There were a few things that Mr. Baker addressed to the court that I would like to clarify for the court. I was present. I was the attorney who made these motions in limine. I was the attorney who was at pretrial readiness on this case. I am co-counsel. We are the ones that issued a subpoena DT to the Office of the Guardian Ad Litem after we received in discovery information that showed the Guardian Ad Litem had gone to a detective and provided this information to impeach the child client. When we got that information, we assumed must not be any confidentiality here. They must be have open information. We filed a subpoena DT in order to obtain the file and to see about notes, to see, because we had been told that the complaining witness had recanted her statements months before and nothing had been done about it. And we wanted to know exactly when she had started recanting her allegations in the case and to see exactly what she had said. When we filed that subpoena DT, the guardian ad litem came into court weeks before the day of trial and argued that the subpoena should be quashed, that they had attorney work client privilege. And we could not get those notes. The judge issued a written ruling in the case saying it is work product. There has to be an attorney-client relationship in order for an attorney to have work product so that their information is not discoverable to us. That information was, all sides had that information. That order was not appealed. The guardian ad litem did not appeal it. The DA did not even ask the judge to reconsider it. Prior to trial, there was a pretrial readiness date, and that is referenced in the transcript from the morning of trial. The DA did not
show. Back up a second. Did that order you're just referring to in any way take into account the your statement or the underlying facts that the GAO had previously disclosed that information to, I think you said, the detective?
Yes.
So was there an issue as to whether that was a waiver or not?
Yes.
And decided that it was not?
We went into court thinking after we saw the discovery, the police...
I'm more interested in the trial court's view of it.
The trial court decided that there was not a waiver there and that that would have to be addressed at trial.
What was the basis of that other
Basically, the assertion from the GAL that the information was privileged. And actually, I'm not even certain at that time that the judge knew the extent of the statements the GAL had made to the detective.
Is that ruling?
Yes, it is. It's in the court file. It's a written ruling in this case.
And is your motion to quash and your subpoena part of that record?
Yes, it is. Yes, it's all in the court file. And so we have this situation. We have the pretrial readiness date where the DA doesn't show up. However, I raised to the trial court on that day, these are the issues we're going to address. I know you want to address them at readiness. She's not here. What do you want us to do? Raise them on the morning of trial. saw the DA in the hallway after the fact, and I referenced this in the transcript on the morning of trial, said to her, I'm raising these issues. Do you want my case law? Do you want all the information I have about this? And she said, no. That's in the transcripts. So this is not something that was out of the blue, 2 hours before we're going to swear in a jury, anything like that. The DA had ample notice of what the situation was in this case. It's not sandbagging.
So why, how does that affect the arguments that we're dealing with? Why?
I think because Mr. Baker is up here telling the court that, you know, they couldn't bring a Rule 21. They were unprepared to do that. That is not the case. Frankly, that was the remedy.
What difference does that make? I mean, does that affect whether we have jurisdiction or not?
Yes, I believe it does.
So then our jurisdictional determination should have into take into account whether the district attorney had enough time or in good faith pursued a Rule 21?
I believe that whether or not they even considered doing that is something the court should take into account, yes. And the reason for that is because there are multiple remedies that they're saying they have here. And it goes towards the new decision in Frye about whether or not it is a final appealable order or not.
And this I just have trouble understanding the sort of flexible jurisdiction issue that you seem to be advocating. That is, in this case, we have jurisdiction because the district attorney didn't have enough time to do a 21. And in this case, we don't have jurisdiction because they had a few more days and could have done a 21.
I'm not advocating for that.
Well, I don't understand.
I think that's what the DA was advocating to you before, is that for some reason they decided not to choose that route because they didn't have the time to get it done. And there was a question about that. And that was not the case here. And instead, they took a course of action that I think was improper. That they went ahead and said, on a collateral issue, this was impeachment of two witnesses. Whether or not that information would have even come up is dependent on whether or not those witnesses would have denied that they made those statements or not, whether we would have even gotten to that point in the trial. The evidence they had on the day of trial was the exact same evidence that they had when they started the case. These were collateral issues.
But I think the trouble is you're talking to us like we're a bunch of trial judges, and that's okay. But so what, you know, given that we're in a different forum now, what is the holding that you would want us to come up with? What do you want our opinion to say?
I would like you to say that in situations like this, as in Frye, that when a DA goes in and basically forces a dismissal on the case, that is not a final appealable order.
And how would we decide when a dismissal is forced? We'd have to go back to the facts, right?
Yes.
So that really does implicate Justice Martinez's question to you, that you have kind of a fact-dependent view of jurisdiction.
Perhaps. The problem is that under the statute, in order to get the jurisdiction under 1612.102, it has to be a question of law. And as I argued in my briefs in this case, these are actually issues that involve questions of law and fact, not just.
But it would be helpful to me, unless there are any other questions, if we could just move on into another area. I don't know about everybody else. If you could just move on then, please.
Sure, I could do that. The next issue I'd like to address has to do with the social worker. That issue, to me, is clearly a question of fact as to whether or not it would have been admissible at trial. It dealt with the impeachment of the testimony of the mother at trial and supposedly pressure she had put on the complaining witness in order to recant her statements. Those statements were made to a social worker. She was required to talk to the social worker as part of the dependency and neglect matter. And clearly, section 19.3207 states that that information is not admissible in a criminal proceeding. We would ask in regards to that issue that the Court of Appeals decision be affirmed. Yes, I have a lot of extra time now. I think I'll probably just cede it to Mr. Coy.
Thank you.
And let him go ahead with the guardian ad litem issue. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Coy, and I am arguing on behalf of the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center, the National Association of Counsel for Children, and the University of Colorado Law School's Juvenile and Family Law Program. Today we are asking the court to affirm the decision of the lower court, finding that a child is the client of the guardian ad litem, and the confidentiality and privilege attached to this relationship. This question presents important public policy issues and issues involving the interests of children. It fundamentally goes around whether children are represented in a dependency case or whether they are represented at all. It does not involve the question, though, of whether, in this case, the trial court and then the Court of Appeals affirming the trial court chose to adopt a traditional adult attorney-client directive relationship between a guardian ad litem and a child. That information was never addressed in the trial court orders, nor did those words appear in the Court of Appeals decision. Instead, the trial court ruled that in representing the child's best interests, the guardian ad litem also represents the child. And this order comports with prior holdings of this court.
So privilege applies. That's your position,
yes.
Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
No exception.
Well, none other than the exceptions that exist currently at law, and those that might also exist with respect to confidentiality pursuant to 1.14. The child certainly, in this case, would be considered a client with diminished capacity.
Proceed. I'm interested in how the child makes the decision about privilege and whether to waive it.
In Hartley, a case that was an opinion that was issued by this court a number of years ago, that case dealt with a domestic relations case. In that case, the statutory provision at play provided that the court shall appoint an attorney to represent the interests of the child in matters with respect to custody and visitation. That language is substantially similar to the language that exists in the Children's Code to the extent that 19.3203 charges the guardian ad litem with the representation in general of the child's interest. And in Hartley, the court held that in representing a child in these type of proceedings, the guardian ad litem has to exercise a higher degree of objectivity and that comports with the child's best interest, but the court held that the attorney nonetheless represents the child, and that provisions of the Colorado Children's Code comport with this rationale, because we have to read the Children's Code in total to understand the intent of the General Assembly. To be sure, the Children's Code provides that an attorney appointed as a guardian ad litem, and I think it's important to note that all attorneys appointed as guardians ad litem for children in dependency cases have to be lawyers. We can safely presume that the General Assembly knew what lawyers do when it required that lawyers be appointed to represent children in this capacity.
Counsel, can I stop you there? Because it raises an issue that I want to explore with you, which is exactly the fact that they have to be attorneys. And just when you read the statute, doesn't a GAL do something that an attorney doesn't do? I mean, certainly there are things that the GAL does that it's very attorney-like, but for example, make recommendations to the court concerning the child's welfare. That isn't something that strikes me as particularly attorney-like, and I'm wondering, how do you deal with some of the provisions in the statute that aren't expressly attorney-like jobs?
Again, in reading the Children's Code in total, it requires the guardian ad litem to act in the child's best interest. Importantly, there's been a lot of discussion about this notion that the Children's Code requires the attorney to represent the child's best interest. That's not what the statute says at issue here. It requires the guardian ad litem to act in the client's best interest. It also requires that the guardian ad litem is appointed for the child and has to carry out her responsibilities to adequately represent the child. Now, to answer the court's question, the responsibility to act in the client's best interest imposes a higher degree of objectivity upon the guardian ad litem. But it does not diminish the fundamental responsibilities that a lawyer has to a person he or she represents. And so to the extent that the guardian ad litem may have to discuss the child's welfare, we can talk about a few examples. There's a hypothetical I've sort of come up with that it involves a child who approaches the guardian ad litem, a teenage client who approaches the guardian ad litem, and confides in the guardian ad litem that she is abusing alcohol or using alcohol to cope with some stresses in her life. And this is not, unfortunately, it's not an uncommon situation in the cases we work with. The client then asks that the guardian ad litem not reveal those confidences. But because the guardian ad litem has to act in the child's best interest and has this higher duty of responsibility to the child, the guardian ad litem can't do nothing. The guardian ad litem has to act to try and protect the child's best interest. But in the same vein, there's nothing in the children's code that authorizes a guardian ad litem to disclose that information. So there are some things, though, that a guardian ad litem can do. For example, the guardian ad litem can sort of narrow in the scope of their investigation. They have a duty to investigate and can narrow in the scope into other aspects of the child's life that that might evidence problems or difficulties she's showing with coping issues. She could, the guardian ad litem could talk to the school. The guardian ad litem could look to the social life. Or
the guardian ad litem said to the school, I think she's abusing alcohol?
I don't think so.
Okay, so the guardian ad litem would have to say, in kind of code almost, there might be a problem with this child. It might be in your interest and the school's interest to look into this problem. That's not much of a rule, is it?
Maybe.
We can't really say there's an attorney-client relationship here and then say, but it can be breached by code, by talking in code.
I agree.
So what is it you're actually suggesting?
Well, the guardian ad litem could ask very general questions. In fact, it's normal for a guardian ad litem to contact schools. The guardian ad litem could talk about the child's grades, the child's attendance, the child's relationship that he or she is having with her peers, whether or not she's having any behavioral difficulties in school. None of these questions would be code to suggest that anything is going on with the child.
In your model, the GAL can't disclose this information, but the GAL can use this information in order to investigate independently and attempt to get to the same place, that is, figure out from somewhere else that this disclosure is true and then reveal that to the court.
Well, it wouldn't.
Isn't that sort of a deceptive model of protecting confidentiality?
It wouldn't necessarily involve revealing the confidences either, Your Honor. There are oftentimes in these cases many instances where there are multiple indicators of a particular issue involved in a case that are distinct.
Let me ask you a different question, but using sort of your example. In your example, if the child were an adult,
yes,
the child, the person, the client, might say, well, I want to talk, I want to make a decision as to whether the adult wanted to disclose this information about abuse and so forth. Or I forget what you're talking about, alcohol use. Let's say that the adult might tell the lawyer, you should tell the court. The lawyer might say, well, I can't do that because it's confidentiality. The adult could then choose to, and maybe already did, to release the lawyer from that.
Yes.
When the adult's a child, in the instance where you have a child as a client, when the client's a child instead of an adult, how does, in your model, the child can't decide to release the lawyer from the GAL from the confidentiality? Is that correct? The confidentiality maintains. Nobody can decide to release or to waive privilege.
I think it raises some difficult issues, but it does not foreclose.
Doesn't that deprive the child of a right that the child would otherwise have?
But it doesn't. Rule 1.4 actually addresses this issue, and actually the court opinion in Hartley touched on this issue as well, and the court in Hartley recognized that there are differing degrees of ability to make informed decisions, and that just because a child or just because a person is under the age of majority does not mean in and of itself they are incapable of making informed decisions. That was language that Hartley.
So in other words, maybe someone who's 17 and very mature might be acting a little more like an adult in weighing whether to waive privilege or reveal or allow the lawyer to reveal confidentialities. A child who is 4 years old, on the other hand, probably has no capacity to do any of that.
The rule suggests, or the comment to the rule talks about children around the ages of 5 and 6 having, you know, the ability to make informed decisions. So on a particular case-by-case basis, there may be a child or there may be a person, an adult, with such severely diminished capacity that they cannot make disclosure. But the rule or the comment to 1.4 also addresses that. It addresses it in the context of taking emergency legal action on behalf of an incapacitated person. And I believe this is comment 9 and 10 to rule 1.14. And comment 9 and 10 specifically say that in situations where an individual is with such severely diminished capacity, even to the point that they are unable to form an attorney-client relationship, the attorney can still take action on behalf of that individual and must abide by the rules of professional conduct, including confidences.
So in your view, most children, with some exceptions of extremely early age or other mental incapacities, most children should be able to decide whether to their lawyer needs to maintain, their GAL needs to maintain confidentiality and may decide whether to assert the privilege.
I think as a general rule, the rules of professional conduct support that conclusion, Your Honor. Also, one thing I haven't talked about is that in Colorado, juveniles can be charged in delinquency cases from the age of 10 on up to 18. And in those cases, they are appointed counsel. And we can safely presume that the legislature has determined that for a 10-year-old who has a defense attorney, the defense attorney may be facing some of the similar issues that the court is posing to me today. But the General Assembly has presumed, I think, through the appointment of a defense counsel for a child 10 years or older, that they have the ability to make some of these disclosures that the court is questioning me about.
But the defense counsel doesn't have the kind of additional duties that Justice Iyed suggested to you at the beginning of this conversation. And her question was, how do you reconcile that?
Well, I agree. Defense counsel or traditional counsel do not have the same responsibilities as a guardian ad litem does. But let me see if I can answer the question this way. The issue we're talking about in this case is whether or not confidentiality and privilege apply to the relationship. And the general notion behind confidentiality and particularly privilege is that because of the trusting relationship or the trusting ability to communicate that principle creates between a client and a lawyer, it actually advances the administration of justice. It encourages full and candid communication, and it encourages early pursuit of advice, early disclosure of problems that need to be addressed. And so looking at it from that point of view, it actually supports the guardian ad litem and his or her ability to do an investigation, because it encourages the child to report to the guardian ad litem.
I'm getting more and more uncomfortable about whether or not we ever envisioned that the rules of professional conduct would apply in this circumstance. What indication is there is that we have articulated or considered this conflict with the statutory goals of the guardian ad litem system?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Which is a very important innovation in Colorado.
I do not disagree, and I have a
So point me to the code where we can hold these guardian ad litem in fear of their license for carrying out their statutory duty.
I don't think that's what I'm advocating the court to do.
Okay, I'm not understanding your position then, and maybe you can help me.
In the Hartley case, this court dealt with the issue of the role that an attorney representing a child's interest plays in that relationship. And as I discussed earlier, this court already stated that the whatever this additional responsibilities are that a guardian ad litem is responsible to, his first and foremost responsibility is to represent the child. And in that case, the court specifically said that in carrying out that relationship, the rules of professional conduct apply to that relationship. And we have cited this case in our brief, and we have, but I can give you the site right now. It's at page 671 of the Hartley case. The court specifically said that the higher degree of objectivity, which we're talking about here, consistent with a guardian ad litem representation, is carried out in addition to not to the exclusion of, or not to the even special exception of, the rules of professional conduct. There have also been a number of other cases that this court has addressed in the last 15 years that also reconcile the role and responsibilities of a guardian ad litem through the rules of professional conduct. One case was addressed earlier, and that is the JCT case. This court issued that opinion about 5 years ago, and in that case, it was a probate case. But the question was whether or not a guardian ad litem appointed in a probate case could be also appointed as a guardian designee for the same individual. And this court went through an exacting review of both the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct and also the Model Rules of Professional Conduct by the ABA to conclude that that type of representation was consistent with the rules of professional conduct. In the JEB case, which was an appellate court case a number of years ago, that issue was whether or not it was about a guardian ad litem testifying. And in that case, the court specifically said that when this situation occurs, when a guardian ad litem testifies in a case, he or she must be mindful of Rule 327. So I don't have a case to point to, Your Honor, that says a lawyer's license is going to be at issue if we adopt this standard, but we do have a series of cases that have looked at similar conflicts, similar notions that they are inherent conflicts in the nature of this relationship, and they have resolved all of these conflicts through application of the rules of professional conduct. And that's what I'm asking the court to do in this case as well.
I had talked to Ms. Dance a little bit about the model where the confidentiality is there and the privilege applies, but it is the GAO who makes a decision about waiver or release of that, and presumably would do so taking into account the child's wishes and the maturity of the child and that sort of thing, but the ultimate decision would be that of the GAO. What are your concerns with that model? I mean, obviously, that's a way to have the GAO representing the child, but also acting in the best interest of the child in determining what that is.
My initial reaction to that question when Your Honor asked Ms. Danz was that traditionally the client holds the privilege, not the lawyer in this case. And so this model that you're suggesting would make the guardian ad litem then either the privilege holder or a surrogate to the privilege holder.
Which doesn't that sort of make sense, since we were talking to Justice Hyde about the fact that the GAL is acting in some ways like a lawyer, but in some ways not like a lawyer at all?
I suppose there's no inherent conflict with that model. And I haven't had the opportunity to put a lot of thought into it. It's the first time I heard it today. I suppose it could work, but again, it sort of puts the... It shifts who the privilege holder is away from where traditionally...
Well, isn't it... I mean, what do you mean there's no inherent conflict? Isn't it directly what you're not arguing? I mean, it's...
What's that?
Isn't it directly opposed to the position you're advocating? That model? I guess I'm just being now confused about your position. That model that we're talking about, your position would directly oppose that, would it not?
Well... There is some overlap. The issue that the OCR and others are sort of the opposite position is that there is no attorney-client relationship to begin with. The child is essentially an unrepresented party in dependency cases, and the GAL's responsibility is solely to the court and not to the child.
What's your position?
My position is obviously that the child is the client of the guardian ad litem, and there's a higher degree of objectivity involved in that relationship. It goes to the scope of the representation, not necessarily who the client of the representation is.
So it would be all right with you then if in terms of defining the scope of the representation, we said that the scope extended only so far as to allow the GAL to exercise his or her judgment with respect to the best interests of the child.
That would not fully
comport. So tell me what's wrong about that.
That would not fully comport with my position, but I think it would be a step in the right direction because it recognizes the fundamental issue that we are attempting to advance today, and that is that children are persons. They're not.
So that's the think about what you're doing kind of standard, right?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Just wondering what kind of rule that is. GAL think about what you're doing here? I mean, that's the basis for discipline, that they didn't make a correct judgment?
I don't understand the court's question.
And would it have anything to do with waiver? I mean, it doesn't make any difference then whether there's a waiver or not, does it? If the holder of the privilege has shifted to the attorney, to the GAL.
Are you referring to Justice Martinez's model?
Mm-hmm.
I think you're correct. And so,
but how is there any overlap from your perspective?
Well, because it recognizes that, one, that this child is a represented person. It also recognizes that the rules of professional conduct do apply to the relationship, particularly confidentiality and privilege. It just makes a sort of carve out of how that privilege might be waived. But fundamentally, it supports the same notion that these are children, that they are persons with their own interest who deserve the legal representation in cases. And so, as I said earlier, it doesn't fully comport with my position, but there is some overlap.
Okay, one quick question. So under 1.4, you could take Justice Martinez's model and accept that, right? The ultimate decision is made by the guardian.
Under 1.14?
Yes, Your Honor? I'm sorry, 1.14, yes.
I think that 1.14 definitely provides guidance. It doesn't, though, authorize the wholesale abdication of the attorney-client relationship, that there are certain circumstances where 1.14 allows a lawyer.
Well, there are other provisions of the rules of professional conduct that would apply as well.
I'm
talking about 1.2 and so forth. But the idea would be that it would be modified by that statute.
Yes. And I think in the comment to 1.2, if I may, I know I'm out of time, if I may just finish this thought. The comment to 1.2, and I don't remember the particular number at this point, but it talks about that there can be modifications to the scope of representation. Typically, that is done in a conversation between a client and a prospective lawyer. It can also be done by nature of court order or how the representation comes to be. And in this case, the representation of children in these cases comes to be through the order of appointment, which could sort of also modify the scope of the representation. Or the children's code that requires the guardian ad litem to act in the child's best interest. All right, so I want to thank you today for taking the time.
On behalf of the court, I thank counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.